The Attorney General wishes to announce that the following program has been rated
liberal rubbish
by the Department of Justice.
All right, guard, begin the unnecessarily slow-moving dipping mechanism.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Isn't he simply adorable, Pop?
I told you, never trust a monkey!
Listen, you smell something?
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down!
Hello and welcome yet again to another episode of the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man and the voice of those who, like myself, find themselves jobless because of the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and the Republican Party. I'm also a proud member of the League of Liberals Blogging Alliance, the largest and fastest-growing such alliance in the blogger ecosystem. Before I begin, I want to thank a couple of people. First, let me thank Ben Birch over at the White Rose Society, that's www.whiterosesociety.org, for archiving back episodes of the Cup of Joe show on their site. I'm glad to see lefties supporting each other, and I'm proud to be on the same page as Mike Malloy, Tom Hartman, Peter Werby, Enid Goldstein, and, of course, the queen of the airwaves, Randy Rhodes. I also want to thank Bart Kopp for mentioning me on his site yesterday as I record this. I'm going to do a promo for his radio show. I keep reminding myself to do that, and I keep forgetting to do it. I'm such a procrastinator. I really, you know, it bugs me sometimes that I'm such a procrastinator, but I'm like that, unfortunately. And, of course, for those of you who aren't aware of Bart Kopp, that's www.bartkopp.com. That's B-A-R-T-C-O-P. Of course, I'm sure most of you already know about him. Okay, what was going on here? You know, last week they held the annual Jefferson Jackson Dinner in Iowa, which is an important gathering of Democrats that takes place prior to the Iowa caucuses. Now, you know, I don't talk about it too much on the show. I mention it occasionally because what I do here on the show is more about an overall cause than it is about a presidential candidate. But I am a supporter of Governor Howard Dean of Vermont, who is at present the front runner among the nine candidates for the Democratic nomination. I did see the dinner on and off, which was hosted. The MC was Senator Hillary Clinton, who had kind words to say about all of the candidates who appeared there. And by the way, there was a great moment where Senator Clinton asked everyone to applaud the people who cooked the food, served the food, and cleaned up afterwards, and there was a long period of applause. You'll never hear that from Republicans, that's for sure, because, you know, the people who pick, who clean up after them and serve their food, they might as well not even exist as far as the Republican Party is concerned. Now, another Dean supporter, Rick Clow, who has his own weblog, he went to the event in person, and he had quite a bit to say about it, not just about Governor Dean, but about the other candidates. And let me read and comment about what he had to say. And Rick's blog, by the way, is www.rklau.com/Dean2004. That'll take you right to the article in question. That's rklau.com/Dean2004. Now, it was notable that everyone who had a role in starting the evening, from Governor Tom Vilsack to Senator Tom Harkin to Senator Hillary Clinton, made a point of saying that the next president would be one of the candidates with us here tonight. And to those who think General Wesley Clark is the Clinton's choice, that's an odd statement for Hillary to make, considering that General Clark wasn't going to be there. And the Iowans there were clearly tweaked that fully one-third of the candidates, actually, aside from General Clark, Joe Lieberman and Al Sharpton didn't show up, skipped the event. And, of course, Mrs. Clinton explicitly stated her support for the candidates, and spoke in such warmed-over tones about moving forward and having hope and looking to the future and supporting to the people that it was hard to distinguish from a mayor's race. Bottom line, she did a good job of setting the stage, lending support to all the candidates and helping the party raise money, all of which, of course, she was supposed to do. What she didn't do, despite what some of the hacks in the so-called professional media are trying to tell us, was dominate the evening. So who did? Well, of course, both Mr. Klaus and I are biased, but here are some observations, both of him and myself. Edwards had a kind of semi-coordinated section of, in other words, it was a big auditorium. It was a Veterans Memorial Auditorium in Des Moines, Iowa, and there were different sections, and for the most part, there were sections that were separated into supporters of different candidates. And Edwards' section was kind of semi-coordinated. They spent the better part of the night trying to spell John Edwards with a collection of posters, but the closest apparently that they got was Joan Enders or something that looked like it. On the positive side, the gathering section for Edwards supporters, there was a poster that said bloggers for Edwards, which those of us who were bloggers thought were pretty cool. And what was interesting was that supporters of Richard Gephardt, who supposedly is the most pro-union of all the candidates, were nowhere to be found. For a candidate with supposedly a 7-point lead in Iowa and a superior organization in Iowa, it was a shocking absence. I mean, like I said, Gephardt is considered to be the main guy as far as unions and working people are concerned. And even though he has a lot of unions behind him, he does not have the most politically active unions behind him. Hang on a second. Let me get a drink of water here. You know, when you do a show like this, even though it's not live, I got to do this live and just take a drink. And even though I'm just pre-recording, I'm just too damn lazy to go out and re-record over. So let me get a drink of water here. Hang on. That's good. More. Okay, I need water from time to time. Now, John Kerry's supporters were there, and they were excellent. In fact, I really liked the enthusiasm that they had. They were very well organized. They were very loudly supportive. They even had cheer lines coordinated with his speech, which is cool. When he asked what the country got when President Bush led us to war, they all yelled, "A raw deal!" There were three sections of Kerry supporters, apparently, and they did a very good job of supporting their candidate. It's too bad that Kerry himself kind of appeared exhausted. You know, Kerry always looks kind of tired. You know, he looks like he's kind of ready to fall. His skin kind of hangs off of his face, and he looks like... You know, I have a lot of respect for Senator Kerry, and if he wins the nomination, of course, I will wholeheartedly support him. But he does look a little tired. I agree with that characterization in that. And he did have a really bad week, and it seems to have taken a toll on him. Now, for those of you who aren't aware of this, Kerry recently abruptly fired his campaign manager, and in response, a couple of his other upper-ranking people quit. So he's had some really major reorganizing to do, and that's very difficult to do, especially when you're faced up against more well-organized campaigns. Dennis Kucinich was there, and his speech was notable for his exuberant support of all the other candidates, and which is interesting because Dennis has really been the one harping on all the other candidates to say some of the things he's been saying. In fact, at one of the debates my wife watched him, she just said he was a little creepy, and I kind of agree. Although, again, I like Representative Kucinich, and I think he's a good, solid worker for the left-wing cause. But it could be that he might be looking to get out of the race at this point, because he had numerous statements about how all the other people were just better than Bush. Now, maybe he's laying the groundwork to get out, like I said. There was a side note from Mr. Klaus there. He said Doug Henk, who was part of DuPage for Dean and traveled with them, met Kucinich in the hotel lobby the morning after the thing. Showing his sense of humor, Kucinich asked him, "Do you think I got my point across that I want us out of Iraq?" And he did talk about that. And Kucinich is a big one about getting the soldiers out of Iraq. And then, of course, there was Carol Mosley Braun also gave a speech, and I saw that. Unfortunately, she had to follow Dean, and I like Carol Mosley Braun. I really do. She's dignified. She speaks well. She's intelligent. But I hate to say it, there's no chance in hell she's going to get this nomination, and there's no chance in hell she's going to win even if she gets the nomination. I think she's a better behind-the-scenes person. She'd make a good – well, she has been an ambassador. She has been a senator. Very smart. Very likable. I like her a lot. I cannot express my admiration for her more. And I wish maybe the situation were otherwise and the country were other than it was, where she would have a better chance. But I really do like her, and I kind of feel bad. But quite frankly, I wish she'd drop out at this point. She's never gotten past the single digits. She barely makes six digits when it comes to fundraising. In fact, most of it can be mentioned in five digits, and, you know, you really can't have that. She has no campaign organization to speak of, which is kind of a shame, but that's the way it is sometimes. You know, you can't always root for the nicest people or even sometimes the best skilled people. Sometimes you have to get the best people that you can get at the time, and that's not always a bad choice. And, you know, we're getting on that because we're going to talk about Howard Nee. Now, the recent National Republic profile of Joe Trippi talks about Joe Trippi's long history with the Jefferson Jackson Dinner and the fact that at his core, Joe is an organizing guy. Now, Joe Trippi is the main guy for Governor Dean. He is the main campaign director for him, and he is very much responsible for a lot of Dean's success in there. And his skill was apparent at the meeting with Iowa staffers wearing matching yellow T-shirts, and on the back it said, "How's my organizing call? 1-866-DEAN-4-US." And they had walkie-talkies with headsets to give and take orders in unison. When the Dean section was found to be missing cowbells, which they were ringing in support of the candidate, one staffer quickly radioed to another section, and the cowbell showed up. The other half of DuPage for Dean was in another section entirely. They were missing signs and got them within minutes. No other campaign had this kind of distributed organization evident throughout the hall. Dean also had the largest of all the signs there, and there was a huge blue and white sign hung over the balcony, and I remember seeing that very clearly, saying, "I see Dean people." I think that was the best sign of all the ones that I saw. Now, some of you may have read the CNN report about the event, where they noted that the Dean campaign needed 43 buses to get from the afternoon rally to the Jefferson Jackson dinner, and apparently the campaign needed a parade permit from the city in order to accommodate that kind of traffic. But the organization goes beyond acquiring permits ahead of time. It included staffers on every bus handing out instructions for the evening, photocopies of the chants they'd be doing at the event, and giving directions for how to behave. "Respect all who respect us" was the mantra of the evening. And the masterstroke, again, it was probably Mr. Trippi's idea, was having Dean get introduced while walking among his supporters. Each of the other campaigns walked the path set out by the organizers and shook the same sets of hands, moving among those fortunate enough to have seats along the path of the floor. Dean's reinforcing his people-powered Howard theme, he showed up not among the $1,000 table floor attendees, but among the $40 ticket seat balcony attendees. The crowd went wild once they figured out where he was, and you can tell Dean fed off of the energy. Now, the real impact of all of this organization was the show of force by the Dean campaign, where Gephardt and Edwards each had one section of support, Kerry had three, Dean had about 12. Not only were the cheers deafening, the matching signs and ringing cowbells were impressive. I mean, the most awe-inspiring part of the night was when Dean was completing his speech, a huge, three huge signs unfurled that said, "Win with Dean." And that was as Dean was getting the crowd going with his "You have the power" line. Although I thought he kind of repeated that a little too much. These banners are like 30 rows long, and you could see something going on. It wasn't until the people jerked them open that you can see the entire section was covered with the one simple message, "Win with Dean." And it was no doubt from that it was Howard Dean that dominated that evening and not Hillary Clinton. And now what was interesting to Rick was that as he and wife were leaving, according to him, they came across an elderly couple wearing Kerry buttons who told them, "You know, your candidate gave a fantastic speech. When we first saw Dean, we figured he didn't have a chance in hell, so we went with a candidate who had the credentials." And no one doubts Senator Kerry's credentials, of course, war hero. And even though he voted for the war thing, he really is against the way things are being handled. And unlike some Dean people, I respect his feelings about that. But in 50 years, they said, "We've never seen the enthusiasm for a campaign like Dean's built. Keep up the good work." And that's very good to hear. And again, I want to reiterate my respect and admiration for Senator Kerry and for Representative Kucinich and for Kara Mosley-Braun, even for Al Sharpton, because I have an admiration for his organizational skills, and he's very good at that, and his speaking ability. I mean, I don't think there's a better candidate that's out there speaking. I wish Howard Dean spoke as well and as sharply as Al Sharpton did from time to time. But Dean is the way he is, and I'm very happy with him and his campaign, which is why I'm part of his volunteer staff, because I think he's doing a good job. And also because when I decided to get involved in a more practical level, his was the only one that had a campaign here in Georgia. Let me get some more water here. You know, if I had a partner, I could take a drink while my partner was talking, but I don't have one anymore. That's all right. I'm dealing with it. Okay. Now, these are what Rick concluded about the evening. Now, Gephardt, who, by the way, I do not like, and even though I will vote for him, it will be a hold-my-nose vote if he wins the nomination. Lieberman, I do not like, not so much because of the Republican life, but because of failed leadership and because, well, Lieberman's so damn smarmy. And he's not going to get elected. He's a softie. He won't fight. He'll give in his heckin'. He's not a fighter. He's a little wussy boy. He's a little wussy boy. That's what you are, Mr. Lieberman. And Gephardt, your leadership, if you can call it that in the House, cost the Democrats power for the first time in 60-something years. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, and you got a lot of balls running for president as far as I'm concerned. But if you by some miracle win the nomination, I'll hold my nose and vote for you. But only because even a failed leader like you is better than evil scum like Mr. Bush. Kerry is looking actually much stronger than the polls would indicate. And, of course, a lot of that is because he does have a dignified presence and because he does have great credentials. But Dean, of course, is far and away the front runner. I mean, he's got motivated and passionate supporters who are willing to do whatever it takes to win. I mean, look, if you want proof of that, the Jefferson Jackson dinner over the weekend was the first one in Iowa's entire history in which a representative from each of Iowa's 99 counties was present. And can you guess which campaign put that together? And that was the Howard Dean campaign. And that's what's impressive about this. And all of this talk about the Jefferson Jackson dinner actually brings me to my other point, which is a larger article from the website Daily Chaos, which is www.dailykos.com, Daily Chaos. And the title of that column was The Battle for the Soul of the Democratic Party. And the fight, which is really right now between Dean and Gephardt more than anything else, is a commentary on an article from the New Republic, which is by Ryan Leza, who, according to Chaos, has some of the best primary coverage you're going to see. And it's a great look into the whole primary campaign up to this point. I mean, it's no secret that the Democratic Party has been split into two factions, the insiders who have run the party the last decade or so, and the Howard Dean / Joe Trippi reformer faction. Let me quote a few lines from the New Republic article. The division in the party over Dean is less about ideology than it is about power. 3 years after Bill Clinton left office, he and Hillary still control what remains of a Democratic establishment. Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, DNC, was installed by Bill Clinton. Most of the powerful new fundraising groups known as 527s and the new think tanks, such as the Center for American Progress, are run by the best and brightest of the Clinton administration. As National Journal noted in a detailed look at what it called Hillary Inc., the senator's network of fundraising organizations has begun to assume a quasi-party status. And some of the best Clinton talent is heavily invested in non-Dean campaigns, especially Joe Lieberman's, which has Mandy Grunwald and Mark Penn, John Edwards, which has Bruce Reed, and Wesley Clark's, which has Bruce Lindsay, Eli Siegel, and Mickey Cantor. Now, on my own thing, I don't necessarily have anything against Bill Clinton, obviously, and certainly I don't have anything against Howard Dean, and I think it's kind of sad that that's what it's kind of boiling down to. But just as Clinton was the face of the new Democrats in 92, Howard Dean is the face of the Democrats here in 2004. And if the Clintons have any ambitions to derail Howard Dean for their own, you know, sake of their own power, I think that's very bad for the party. Now, to go on with the article, Dean, by contrast, has come to represent the party's anti-establishment forces, while the other candidates, especially former self-styled frontrunner John Kerry, started the campaign by wooing party leaders, Dean first built the grassroots army, in part by bashing D.C. Democrats and their disastrous 2002 election strategy, and is only now levering his fundraising power to win over establishment types. No Democrats closely associated with the Clintons are working for the Dean campaign. In fact, it's hard to find a Clintonite who speaks favorably of the former Vermont governor. This evident schism is not just about Dean's opposition to the war or even his prospects in the general election. It's a turf war to decide who will control the future of the party. And let me say this. I have the most tremendous respect for President Clinton, and I sincerely hope that it's not a case of him trying to derail it just because he wants a little more power. I frankly don't think that way of President Clinton, because President Clinton understands the important issues, and the important issue is not always who's in power and who's in control, at least as far as vanity is concerned. I think in the long run, even in the short term, he'll probably come to understand how important the Dean campaign is to the vitality of the Democratic Party. Now, this struggle, back to the article, is playing out in several of the party's organizations and constituencies. Indeed, Dean's high-profile labor endorsements, the cornerstone of the tipping point argument, actually emphasize the party's divisions. Andy Stern, the leader of the SEIU, the Service Workers Union, is to the labor movement what Dean is to the Democratic Party, an anti-establishment reformer. And to get back to me for real quick, this is what I'm talking about when I said the smart ass and the high horse arguments. The high horses are out there who don't really understand that the need for the kind of energy in the fight back. And while Clinton understood that in 92, perhaps some of the people that were with him are more concerned with keeping their hold on power now than they are in continuing to fight back against the real enemy, which, of course, is the leadership of the Republican Party and George Bush in particular, and Karl Rove in particular. Now, when the AFL-CIO failed to adopt reforms recommended by Stern earlier this year, he started a breakaway organization, the New Unity Partnership, with several other unions that is now seen as a major challenge to the AFL-CIO establishment. And the SEIU is a lot like the Dean campaign. It's the fastest-growing union and one of the most democratically run. It's obsessed with organizing new members, which I feel unions need to do, and to whom it imparts a message of empowerment. Unlike the more centralized AFL-CIO, and that's been a problem of American unions in the past, is that they get a little overly centralized, and the workers in it very often feel unrepresented by their leadership, which of course led to a lot of corruption throughout the 60s and probably continuing up till the recent past. Stern and the SEIU, with their emphasis on health care instead of globalization, and the big strikes in the supermarkets out in California are in part because of health care issues. In fact, it's a combination of that and the supermarket's reaction to Walmart, and I'll get to that at another time. But they are the future of the labor movement in the United States, while the industrial unions, which back Dick Kefcart and have been bleeding members for years as they fight an uphill battle against free trade, are the past. The SEIU's backing of Dean isn't a nod from the establishment. It's a protest against it, and that's an important thing. This is new labor, to borrow a tone from Tony Blair's New Labor Party. This is new labor, and these are the people that are going to be representing workers in the future. Now, let me highlight the key sentence of that. The division in the party over Dean is less about ideology than about power. And this is more clearly apparent when you look at moderate Democrats. Now, this breed supposedly is all anti-Dean, right? Well, you're wrong about that. According to the article, the Dean split is mirrored in the centralist New Democrat movement as well. No organization has been more hostile to Dean than the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC. In May, Al Frum and Bruce Reed, the chairman and the president of the DLC, the group that served as a policy springboard for Clinton's rise, wrote their now infamous manifesto warning that nominating Dean, who they view as hopelessly left-wing, would bring certain defeat for the Democrats in 2004. But for months under, another prominent New Democrat has been making a different case, Simon Rosenberg, who cut his teeth on Clinton's 1992 campaign and prominent New Democrat, has been making and heads the New Democratic Network, NDN. He sees Dean as the most innovative and potentially transformative Democrat since Clinton himself. Like Stern, Rosenberg is a bit of a rebel within his own movement. He once worked for Fromm, but his organization is now challenging the Democratic Leadership Committee and is becoming an increasingly influential player in the Democratic politics. Unlike the more top-down DLC, NDN is building a grassroots network of donors and has become a key player in the new world of 527s. According to Rosenberg, NDN has not only endorsed Dean, has not endorsed Dean or embraced him, but we have given our opinion that this is a serious campaign that is going to change the party, end quote. Now, divisions over ideology can be easily accepted in our party. I mean, the Democrats are like that. We're far less lockstep than the right-wing Republicans are. We do indeed have a big tent, and we invite policy to, well, you know, not so much invite it, but we accept them as a reality we can learn to live with. In fact, we have to live with them because we live in a complex world, and everybody has their own issues. Electoral realities mean that Democrats in the South have to be more moderate or conservative than those in the West Coast or in New England. I mean, that's just a fact of life. Democrats here in the South, as I've discovered, are far more conservative, and I feel a little more inclined to hold my nose when I vote for them, but they're still better than the right-wing Republican jerks, although I have my doubts now about Zell Miller. He might as well be a Republican as far as I'm concerned. Now, if Dean does win the nomination, as things are looking so far, he becomes the nominal head of the Democratic Party. Unlike, of course, the Republicans, where the guy who's president is more than likely just a puppet for the corporate interests that really control the party. And, of course, if Dean gets to that position, he gets to replace Mr. McAuliffe and fill the top ranks at the DNC. Suddenly, a DNC chairman, Joe Trippi, is a real possibility, and for an establishment that has spent the better half of the last 10 years laughing at Trippi's antics and dismissing him as a kook, are suddenly standing on shaky ground. And, of course, I've seen some of the establishment distaste for Dean myself. I've seen it on some message board. I've seen it among people on Democratic Underground and even among some policy people. But the piece that I read just part of there really puts the blame on the Clinton crew, and that's probably where it deserves to be at this point, because it is more about concern about who's going to control the party influence. And if Bill Clinton was still in office, we wouldn't be having a lot of the things that are going on today. I still believe that if it hadn't been for the constitutional amendment that Republicans passed because they couldn't get Franklin Roosevelt out of office, that Bill Clinton would be our president now, and the Twin Towers would still be there. But that's another story altogether. You know, now as the party split into the Dean people and the Clinton people unfolds, one of the most intriguing subplots concerns Al Gore. Now, immediately after the Florida debacle, Gore's senior aides were purged from the Democratic National Committee, and Clintons were installed. A lot of them were upset that Gore didn't use Mr. Clinton as much as he should have in the election. And I kind of agree with that assessment because Clinton is a master campaigner, and he probably could have pulled votes to Gore in the South that would have helped him to win the election. Some ex-Gore staffers are bitter about this, about their being thrown out of the DNC, and several express admiration for what Dean is doing. And Gore himself seems to be modeling his resurgence on the Dean phenomenon. The two men have a strained history, but lately Gore is sounding more and more like Dean. His three most important speeches since leaving office have been harsh attacks on President Bush's Iraq policy and his abuse of the Patriot Act. The two most recent were delivered before MoveOn.org, the internet network for grassroots liberals, which is overwhelmingly pro-Dean. And they just, by the way, got $5 million from George Soros to help them out. And it's good to see, finally, deep pockets on the left coming to help us out. And I may have some other news on that front in a few days on my next show, and I'll keep you posted on that. Now, it's not a bad way for Mr. Gore to exercise influence in the party if he wants to make a potential endorsement more powerful, or if he still harbors hopes of running for president in 2008, depending on what happens in 2004. If Governor Dean or one of the other Democrats gets elected in 2004, I seriously doubt anybody is going to want to challenge them, considering what they're up against. But all the rest of the Democratic infrastructure is pretty much controlled by the ex-Clintons or the Clintons. Now, the real danger, of course, is that the establishment will try to sabotage Dean. And if he gets nominated, in order to save itself, they might try to sabotage. I mean, that's disgraceful. The notion of a true grassroots-generated political movement with decentralized power nodes threatens to diminish the need for proponents of the old-school top-bottom political structures, that is, the high horses. There are myriad consultants who may suddenly find themselves obsolete, and they're not happy about it. And frankly, good, because they deserved it. If they're gonna pull this, they'll deserve it. Now, I'm an optimist, of course, and I hope that the establishment, just like Daily Chaos does, will realize the power of what Dean and the SEIU in the union area are doing and embrace it, whether Dean wins a nomination or otherwise. And I've said this before. Getting Dean elected president is less important than building the movement. I certainly want to get Governor Dean elected, and that's fine and all too good, but we have to build up a movement to really seriously counter what's going on with the right wing. Seriously, counter them. And that's why you got to have, organizations like the Center for American Progress, who needs to get up off their ass and do a lot more than just write a few articles here and there. They need to really take action and look at the people down here like myself and get us up there and get us working so that we can help fight for the cause. Dean has gotten the support of so many people. And all of his Democratic opponents are just struggling to make an impact. I mean, the establishment, if the establishment is going to throw away that kind of power, they're going to do so at their own peril, because it's going to hurt them more than anything else. Now, when I was watching Dean's speech at the Jefferson Jackson dinner, I found it remarkable that he said, "What we're doing is more important than electing Howard Dean president." I mean, he said this. Okay, he's right. The important thing is not to win a single office, but to build a movement powerful enough to counter the corporate powers that now run the show. It doesn't matter if we elect Dean or Kerry or Clark if the Republicans continue to use their domination of the message to tear him apart at every turn. These people never sleep. I was watching C-SPAN the other day, and I forgot which book author it was. He was the co-author of the guy who wrote Bushwhacked with Molly Ivins. I forget his name, but he was talking about how he was giving a speech about the book, and he jokingly asked if there was a relative of Karl Rove's in the office, in the audience, or brother or sister. And, nobody answered, and he went on, he talked about his book, so on. Actually, I think the book was Bush's Brain. At any rate, when he got home, there was an email from Karl Rove himself saying, no, it was an aunt with a tape recorder who recorded the whole thing. These people never sleep. They are dedicated, and they are willing to spend the time it takes and the money it takes to win for what they believe is right, even though what they believe to me is against everything this country is supposed to stand for. They're willing to stand up and fight for it, and we have to fight back on that. We need to get rid of the influence of big money in politics. We need to minimize it as much as possible. We'll never get rid of it completely. You know, the powers that be, the people who have always kind of run things from behind in this country, I've always had influence far exceeds their actual numbers in the population, and it's probably always going to be that way. But we can certainly minimize the effect that they have, because our government needs to be representative by the people who are governed, by the people who vote them into office, and not by the people who pay the campaign bills. It's going to be a long, hard haul, even if we do win, but we can't let that stop us. We have to remember that this is a marathon and not a sprint, that it takes time to make things happen. You know, it took 30 years for the right to get where it's at today, and it may take longer for us to fight them back, especially since so few of us want to engage in the kind of hardball tactics they want to. And what I'm afraid of is that if Dean does win the nomination, and by God wins the presidency, which I hope he will do, then we'll kind of say, okay, we've done what we need to do, and then just forget about it. No, we can't do that. We have to continue fighting, because these people never sleep. And we will never be safe until we have cut their power down and at least made them to the point where they have to rely on their ideas to win, and not how much money they can throw into propagandizing through ownership of radio networks and through ownership of television networks and newspapers and magazines and controlling the message. When we have a free and open debate in this country, then we'll really be free. So, anyway, this has been a long thing. We'll have some music, and we'll be back.
Tears because our baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke, got so choke up and foe. Kiss on the close up, miss our wills, I can't reform. No God like Hocus Pocus, so don't sit back, kick back and watch the world get worse. Crack news that's in your neighborhood is under attack. Put away the crack before the crack put you away. You need to be there when your baby's old enough to relay.
So don't delay. Now supplies are running out. Allow it, don't spill a lot. 6 to 8 years to arrive. And if you follow them, may be out tomorrow. But if you're off the shun, you might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun.
The supernatural is something that isn't supposed to happen, but it does happen.
I didn't know that I had a sickness, and I've got to do what I can to see that others who are suffering from this get help before they do the stupid things that I did. What is so funny? My friends, this is really tough for me. It really is because
it is not heresy, and I will not recant.
Yes, if the witches are worshipped, the dice fall, men fucking lay there. Damn yourself and your company, my love, to love your baby. Steering around, just swinging in the trees, they mack you like a smith's chair. Bearing me an angel guide, I need some inspiration.
Yeah! Devil man, devil man,
call him
devil man.
I didn't know.
I didn't know either, baby. That was White Zombie with a Little Help. That was Devil Man. And before that, we had Smash Mouth, Walking on the Sun. Welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man. Now, of course, Rush Limbaugh, our old friend, is back on the air again, which is typical of American justice. You know, if a poor black man did what Rush did, that is, intimidate people into getting illegal prescription drugs, and I stress that I mean illegal in the sense that since he personally wasn't the person who the drugs were prescribed for, his obtaining them, therefore, was illegal in and of itself, never mind the mafia-style tactics he used to get them. Now, if a poor black man, again, were to be caught doing similar things, he'd be sitting in a prison cell somewhere. But, of course, Rush is a rich white male and a Republican, and therefore never has to face any real consequences for his own actions. Now, when this whole thing first blew up way back in October, Bill McClellan of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch wrote an outstanding piece that highlights the incredible hypocrisy of Rush and the unbelievable stupidity of his dittohead audience. He wrote a piece about what Rush would say if the same exact thing happened to Bill Clinton. And we're back on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Talent on loan from God. Yes, sir. Now, lots of talk to talk about today. You all know that already Bill Clinton, our former president, has admitted an addiction to prescription drugs. So it's interesting to see the way the liberal media are playing this. I'm looking at a copy of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Saturday, October the 11th edition, the day after the big announcement. Well, the story is on page 2, and right next to his photograph, in large, bold-faced print, is the following quote, "I take full responsibility for this problem." Now, that's interesting, folks, because if you look at his actual statement, not what the liberal media say he said, but what he really said, you get a different take on it. First, he says he's got back problems, so he's blaming it on that. Then he says he had surgery, but the surgery wasn't successful, so he's blaming it on the doctors. Then he says the pain medication was addictive, so he's blaming it on the pharmaceutical companies. Folks, he's blaming it on everyone but himself. But as long as he puts that obligatory line about taking responsibility, that's what the liberal media are going to grab. Clinton takes full responsibility. Now, here's another interesting thing in his statement. I love this one. He says a lot of athletes have admitted drug problems and have been treated like heroes. Huh? Huh? Can you name one athlete who admitted a drug problem and then was treated like a hero? How about Daryl Strawberry? Maybe liberals thought Strawberry was a hero, but I don't think most of us felt that way. And then Clinton says, "I refuse to let anyone think I'm going to do something heroic here." You want to know what this is all about? He's telling his friends in the liberal media how he wants this thing played. He wants to be called a hero for admitting his problem. That's why liberals confuse so many people. They mean the opposite of what they say. And I'm telling you, folks, the liberal media are going to do it. He's going to be a hero. I can already see the spin on this. Clinton accepts responsibility, doesn't blame others. I know you don't believe me. Rush, not even the liberal media can pull that one off. But just watch, I'm telling you, just watch. Another thing I heard him say on the radio the other day, he was whimpering, "I want to tell you about this because you're like family to me." If there are any liberals out there listening, I'd like to ask you this. Weren't you people like family 6 weeks ago? How about 6 months ago? 2 years ago? But he didn't feel the need to tell you then, did he? So why now? You think it could be because he's been caught? Because his high-priced attorneys told him that he'd better act remorseful? And speaking of getting caught, have any of you read about those tapes and emails the cops have? Won't you read them in the mainstream? You won't read them in the mainstream press or hear about them on the Clinton News Network, but they're a hoot. He sounds like he's auditioning for the part in the next Cheech and Chong movie. He calls the money cabbage. He refers to his favorite pills as blue babes. It's always interesting to hear the way somebody talks when he thinks nobody is listening. I know what liberals are going to say. This is a time for compassion. Let me be very clear about this, folks. I have compassion. But my compassion is for all the people who believed in the guy. He was their shining star. He could do no wrong. But you know something? I probably don't have to worry because his followers are going to still believe in him. That's the thing about liberals. You can't convince them. You can show them the facts. You can say, look, here is what he really said, and here is what he really did, but they don't want to know the truth. That's the big difference between them and us. Liberals are afraid of the truth. This is Rush Limbaugh. I'll be back. And that, of course, was the world's worst impersonation of Rush, but I think you get the general idea. And it's remarkable because all the things that, you know, were being said there were exactly what Rush said. And he would, of course, spin it exactly that way if the situation had been reversed. Now, you know, I'll be honest, I don't have any compassion. I don't have any compassion for Rush. I don't have any compassion for his listeners. I don't have any compassion for the people who put him on the airwaves in the first place. Why? Because they don't have any compassion. And this has long since, it's long past the point of just being nice for the sake of being nice. Because frankly, if they had their way, they'd kill us. They'd shut me down, they'd put a bullet to my head, and they'd kill me. That's what they'd do if they had the chance. They haven't done it yet. They haven't reached that point yet. We're still in the creeping fascism stage where we have elements of fascism, but we haven't gotten quite to the point where we're ready to go out into the night and start breaking windows and breaking heads. We're getting there. And it'll get worse if they're allowed to continue to dominate the media, and if they're allowed to let Rush get away with this without any serious punishment. He belongs in jail, people. He belongs in jail. If you're going to be out there harping on people to obey the law or get punished for it, then he ought to follow his own advice. Turn yourself in, go to jail. But you won't see that, because like I said, he's a Republican. Republicans are never accountable. They'll tell you lie after lie, and nobody calls them on it. They'll decry people who do illegal things, and yet they'll steal millions of dollars from your pocketbooks in the form of not just bad policies, but intentionally thieving policies. Because that's what that's all they want. The only people who exist as far as they're concerned are them and their friends. Those are the only people in the world who exist. Outside of that little coffee clutch, every one of us can just go drop dead, except for the ones that are useful, like the ones who are going to clean up after them and clean up their messes. They don't have any compassion for us. There's no sense of real remorse or repentance. And why should they? Because they're never going to really be affected by the things that they do. So, Rush, I wish you well, but get the hell off the air and get your ass in jail where it belongs. Because you're a hypocrite, and your listeners are even bigger jerks than I could ever imagine. You broke the law in a major way. You broke the law in a major way. We're not talking a parking violation here. We're talking about illegal drug use. And you can try to spin it as saying prescription drug use, but the fact of the matter is the drugs weren't prescribed to you. And you intimidated and you forced people to get these drugs for you illegally because you weren't allowed to have them. You were not prescribed these drugs. So here's to all the hypocrisy of Rush and all of his listener dittohead idiots on the right.
Shut your fucking face, Uncle Fucker. You're a cock-sucking, ass-licking Uncle Fucker. You're an Uncle Fucker, yes, it's true. Nobody fucks Uncle Fat like you.
Shut your fucking face, Uncle Fucker. You're the one that fucked your uncle, Uncle Fucker. You don't eat or sleep or mow the lawn. You just fuck your uncle all day long.
What's going on here?
Uncle Fucker, 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 fuck, got a heater in my truck, and I'm off to the rodeo. And it's Alabama left and Alabama right. Come on, you fucking let me get you right, step right. Get off the stage, you goddamn dude, you know. You piss me off, you fucking jerk. Get on my nerves. Well, here comes Johnny with his pecker in his hand. He's a one-ball man, and he's off to the rodeo. And it's Alabama left and Alabama right. Come on, you fucking dummy, get your right, step right. Get off the stage, goddamn dude, you know. Piss me off, fucking jerk. Get on my nerves. Truck and I don't give a fuck cause I'm off the rodeo. Alabama left and Alabama right. Come on, you fucking dummy, get your right, step right. Get off the stage, goddamn dude, you know. You piss me off, fucking jerk. Get on my nerves. Well, here comes Johnny with his pecker in his hand. He's a one ball man and he's off the rodeo. Fucking jerk, get on my nerves.
Ah, yes, that's one of the things that you can get away with on an internet radio show, since I'm not being broadcast and since I don't have a manager to scream at me. That was Chris Ledoux with the unexpurgated version of the rodeo song. And before that, we had the kids from South Park with Shut Your Fucking Face, Uncle Fucker, from the film South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. And I can't think of a better attitude towards Rush Limbaugh and his dittohead listeners. Welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man. And it was a story that just broke today. Came out in Massachusetts, where the High Court of Massachusetts, the highest court, ruled that gays have the right to marry under the state constitution. And that's going to set the stage for a big fight. Now let's talk about this, because this to me goes to the very essence of what freedom is. When you're talking about a secular institution such as marriage, in the secular legal point of view, and Governor Dean talks about this too, and straightforwardly as I can put it is this. This is really about nothing more than economics and legal issues. That's the real issue of this. Because all, you know, not all marriages go on churches. You know, not everybody who gets married in a church. Some are simply, you sign the paperwork and you're married and that's it. I mean, legally, there's no requirement for any kind of church ceremony. There isn't, none at all. really, all it deals with are issues like taxation, inheritance, hospital visitation rights, things along those lines, legal issues. It has nothing to do with anything else. Okay? Now, of course, this is a good wedge issue for Republicans, because a lot of their hardcore supporters are extremely anti-gay. They're the type of people who went out to Long Island a while ago. There was a few of them from Kansas, and granted, it wasn't many of them, but, you know, they went from Kansas all the way to Long Island. And I want to make this clear, that what was going on in Long Island, which is in New York, it's one of the boroughs of New York, they had a problem with what they call hazing at a local high school. Hazing is where athletes beat the crap out of each other to prove how tough they are. It happens in the Marines. It happens in other places. Okay? And apparently there were some instances of sodomization of some of the students there. It really wasn't necessarily a homosexual thing. In fact, I don't think it was a homosexual thing at all. It was just tough jock type guys being tough jock type guys doing the stupidest things imaginable to prove how tough they are. Okay, but for some reason, these people in Kansas got the idea that the people who lived in this Long Island area where the high school is were being supportive of homosexuals because of this. I don't know how they got to. I mean, it was a huge incident that was being investigated. People got arrested I don't know if people got arrested, but there was a big brouhaha about it, mostly because of the hazing issue. It was not even a homosexual issue. But here come these people out of Kansas, no doubt hardcore Republicans, hardcore Bush supporters, holding signs that says, God hates America, God hates fags, God caused 9/11. That's the type of people that this issue here is going to energize, because they see it as a threat to their existence. Why? I don't know. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. If we believe in freedom in this country, we believe that people are free to make their own decisions about their lives. And part of that is who they want to spend their lives with. Now, if they want to have a church ceremony and the church says no, to me, that's between them and their church. And I don't believe the federal government has any place in going to a federal church and putting a gun, figuratively, to a preacher's head and forcing them to perform a marriage ceremony. That's not going to happen, nor should it happen. To me, that's a matter between them and the church. But the church are not the only ones who could perform marriage ceremonies. And the church doesn't have legal authority above and beyond their ability to perform a ceremony. If someone wants to get married without a church ceremony, they can do it. And the church, any church, regardless of what faith you're talking about, doesn't have the right to oversee the secular responsibilities of a government. Give unto God what is God's, give unto Caesar's what is Caesar's. That's what Jesus said. I reversed it a little bit. That's what he said. But the Republicans are great at framing the message. This is what they win on all the time. And all they're going to do is scream, gay marriage, gay marriage, gay marriage, gay marriage. That's the only two words that you're going to hear coming out of their mouths for the next few months while this gets bounced around the courts. But it's not about gay marriage in the sense of, oh, we want you to, you know, get homosexuals in a church and force them at gunpoint to perform these marriage ceremonies. That's not what this is about. This is about the Supreme Court of Massachusetts confirming, even though, and it was a 4-3 vote. How do you get a 4-3 vote on this? It should be unanimous. But they confirmed that it's unconstitutional to create secondhand citizens on the basis of sexual orientation. If you're looking at it from a strictly legal secular point of view, a guy and a guy or a girl and a girl have a right to say, okay, if I die, then my partner will be allowed to inherit without being challenged. Or if my partner is sick, I have legal visitation rights. Or if we want to file as a couple as far as taxations are concerned, to take advantage of some of the benefits and even take some of the risks that entail all married people, that should be up to them. And the federal government shouldn't say no because we only recognize this as being a legal bonding. It's just plain wrong, and it's anti-freedom. And that's the real bottom line to it. What the Republicans are going to do with this issue is anti-freedom, and that's exactly how we should phrase it. It's none of their damn business if Bob and Steve want to get together and have a relationship. If the church doesn't like it, that's fine. No one's telling them they have to like it, but they better damn well accept it. Let God handle it, if that's what you're talking about. If it's God's business, let God handle it. You do not have the right to act on God's behalf. And it would seem to me that God can act on his own behalf. But I do not want a situation, either way, I don't want a situation where the government is going into a church and saying, you have to marry these people. And I don't want a situation to say, no, these people can't inherit when one person leaves one to another one because our church disagrees with their lifestyle. It can't go either way. Adam and Steve, as the homophobic brigade comes out, have the right to visit each other if one is in the hospital. They have the right to get the same kind of tax breaks or even take the same risks that married couples do from strictly a legal secular point. The religious point of view is completely different, but that's how this issue is going to be hammered. And that's how they're going to do that, because they control the message. And let me get into that other story, because it also has to do with controlling the message. Now, you know, as you know, Mr. Bush, as we speak, as I'm recording this, is arriving in London. It probably has already arrived for meetings with Tony Blair and with the royal family. Of course, Mr. Bush is very close to the royal family in the sense of that's who he wants to be like. That's what the Bush family considers itself to be, royalty. Divinely placed in power. They rule by divine right. That's how they see themselves. But there are millions of protesters out there, and there was a big brouhaha over how much authority that U.S. security forces were going to have. They wanted to essentially shut down central London for Bush to visit. You know, whenever a U.S. president visits, there's usually a big parade, and the president of whatever party goes out there and, you know, waves from the car and does all that stuff. And for the most part, people are supportive. And you know something? I'll tell you this. For the most part, the British are supportive of the American people. And they're supportive of America in general. But they don't like Mr. Bush, and they don't like what he represents. And I, for one, say more power to him. Go out there and make as much noise as possible, and let him know. Because he lives in his own little bubble. Whether it's of his own choice or not, he doesn't want to hear anybody who speaks against him. And he's doing the same thing in London that he's been doing all over the United States. These ridiculous freedom of speech zones, free speech zones, what the hell is that? You toss people inside a box or a cage miles away from an event or far enough so that they can't be seen or heard by this man. But of course, you can go there with signs supportive of the president. Those are allowed to be closed. This is what I talk about when I talk about creeping fascism. Do you think Adolf Hitler would allow anybody to be in public displaying dissent? Of course, the Nazis were more straightforward about it. They simply had them killed. And as I said before, they're not quite ready to go to those extremes yet. Maybe they feel like it's a little overboard. Maybe they never will get to that point. But it's just enough of a corporate world where everything that the leadership does is kept secret. And we're just supposed to follow along. Now, he's going to give a speech to a small group of invitation-only people. And he's never going to get a chance to hear anybody, any real design. He was supposed to give a speech before Parliament, before the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Britain's political system, they have a parliamentary democracy, which is different from ours. You don't vote, for example, for the Prime Minister directly. You vote for the local party. And the local party chooses who is going to be the government. And the Prime Minister is chosen from their ranks. The only people who vote for Tony Blair directly are the people who are in Tony Blair's specific district. Other than that, they do not vote for him for Prime Minister. They vote with the understanding that he's going to be made Prime Minister, or whoever their particular party picks, if they win enough seats in Parliament. Now, what I find interesting, and what I like to watch upon occasion, is that the Prime Minister, once every now and then, I think it's a weekly thing, I'm not really sure, so don't quote me on it, but he's got to go out and go in front of the Parliament and into the Commons and answer questions from opposition leaders and you know, listen to supporters, you know, comments from supporters and stuff like that. But he has to go out there and face them, face to face. Mr. Bush would never do that, and he is not going to speak to Parliament because a lot of Labour people were talking about turning back and walking out, and he can't handle that. He cannot handle the set. Just like our dear friend Rush, who locks himself up in his own little bubble, or Bill O'Reilly, who locks himself up in his bubble on his TV show, where he doesn't allow any real dissent, telling people to shut up or cutting off their mics. They can't stand that, because they know when people push back that they're in trouble, because they have to control the message and control the media, and that's a big part of what's going on. I don't even know why he's going there. I don't even know why he's going there. I mean, there's no point in it if the bulk of the population is against them. And don't believe any of this claptrap about how popular Bush is that you're hearing from the so-called professional media. It's not true. If the British are supportive of America and Americans, they're expressing their support for, and not even just liberals like myself, but intelligent, rational people in America who recognize the fact that America is part of an international community and not simply the biggest bully pushing everybody around. And for the most part, Americans are really like that. We've just kind of put ourselves into a position where we're, what's the word, in denial about what's going on. But most of us are not like Mr. Bush. And if for those of us who are really of good heart and who are just simply misinformed, like my wife had been for so many years, you know, they're good people. They're just being used. But then, and of course, there is still a percentage of people who are like Bush and who do enjoy what Bush is doing. They're happy because they have a guy in office who's got an R in front of his name. You know, he's a Republican. That's all they care about. It's all a big pissing contest to them. There are Democrats who are the same way, too. Difference is the Democrats aren't in power and aren't running things right now. You know? So, I think it's really telling when Mr. Bush, wherever he goes, even to a country that's considered to be our closest ally, that he has to have these massive security measures. And I look at recently when President Clinton went to Bosnia and Serbia and those places, and he was greeted as a hero. It was a holiday. There were throngs of people willing to talk to him, shake his hand, and say thank you. Because even though there was a lot of protestations about what they did in Bosnia, the truth of the matter is it worked. And it worked because they had a plan for what happened afterwards, and it worked because they had the cooperation of NATO, which, if you remember, is an international organization. Even though it's still majority American, General Clark, who is now running for president, and is a man I admire very much, he was the general in charge of the bulk of that. And the Bosnians, and wherever Bill Clinton goes, whether he goes to France or whether he goes to India or Japan, he is greeted by throngs of people. He is very popular because he does represent what is good about America, the good things that America's done. When he goes to Africa, he's greeted by throngs of people. You won't see that with Mr. Bush. They have to have massive security measures for him. Wherever he goes, even within America, he has to be kept away from the protesters. Anyway, that's the State of the Union right now. We'll be back.
Slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to us all. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry. There was a dry wind, and it swept across the desert and curled into the circle of blue. And the dead sand falling on the children, the mothers and the fathers and the automatic earth. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry. It's a turnaround jump shot, it's everybody jump start, it's every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the babbling heart. And I believe these are days, lasers in the jungle, lasers in the jungle somewhere. Staccato signals of constant information, a loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires and babies. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is a long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to us all, oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in the corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry.
Throw back a bottle of beer. Try it.
Bush's favorite group in the world with Goodbye Earl. Before that, we had Cherry Poppin' Daddies with Zoot Suit Riot, and we hope to see some sort of riot out there in the streets of London, some sort of message to Mr. Bush on his visit there. And, of course, what Mr. Bush is, the boy in the bubble. That was Paul Simon from the excellent album Graceland. Okay, here we go. From the pages of democraticunderground.com, it is time for the top 10 conservative idiots of the week. And topping the list this week are Senate Republicans. Okay, hands up. Who watched that 39-hour judicial nominations wankathon last week? I know I didn't. Well, okay, I did tune in once or twice. The entire colossal waste of time was perpetrated by Republicans who so pissed off that Democrats just won't roll over and nominate four of Bush's nutjob justices. They were just trying to score political points by holding a multi-day crybaby fest. Never mind the fact that Democrats have already approved 168 of Bush's judicial nominees. Nah, that's not good enough for the power-mad Republicans, who for some reason are laboring under the misapprehension that they have a huge mandate for this kind of crap. I mean, here's a thought, guys. If you want the Democrats to approve every single one of Bush's justices, how about getting him to nominate some people that are acceptable to everyone, not just the crackpot wingnuts? Gee, there's a thought. Meanwhile, let's not forget that one of Bush's most important campaign promises in 2000 was his pledge to change the tone in Congress and bring the two sides together in a bipartisan explosion of goodwill and compromise. Not that he's managed to keep any of his other campaign promises, mind you, except the one about shoveling fat piles of cash to his multimillionaire buddies. Now, of course, the Senate Republicans weren't alone in this fiasco. They had a little help from their old pals at Fox News. Now, the odor of hypocrisy surrounding George W. Bush grew even more repugnant when he pulled out his favorite chestnut and accused Democrats of playing politics with his judicial nominations. Well, I haven't heard that one used for, about 5 minutes. But who's really playing politics here? Last week, a leaked memo from Elizabeth Keyes, the senior communications advisor for the Senate Republican Conference, revealed that the Senate Republicans were in cahoots with Fox News over the theatrical aspects of this colossal waste of time. I mean, very important debate. The memo to Republican staffers said, "It is important to double efforts to get your boss to S230 on time. Fox News Channel is really excited about this marathon, and Britt Hume at 6 would love to open with all our 51 senators walking onto the floor. The producer wants to know we will walk in at exactly 6:02 p.m. when the show starts so that they can get it live to open Britt Hume's show. Or if not, we can give them an exact time for the walk-in." So let me get this straight. Fox News isn't just spinning the news anymore. They're actually working directly with the Republicans to stage manage the news. God, is there no end to the impartiality of the Fox News Network? Now, of course, next on the list is George W. Bush, and our great leader could be in for a shock when he visits the United Kingdom this week, and he's going to show up tomorrow as I'm recording this. Massive protests are being planned, and London's Metropolitan Police appear to be decidedly uninterested in recreating W.'s infamous First Amendment zones in the capital. It appears that Team Bush arrogantly attempted to get the Met to shut down the city center for 3 days, but Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London, is making sure that Bush won't be protected from the indignity of actually having to see the protesters as he is at home. Bush has taken all this in stride, of course, saying last week that, "I'm so pleased to be going to a country which says that people are allowed to express their minds." Yes, that'll certainly make a change from being in the United States these days. But Bush added, "Certainly, they should agree with the goals of the United States, which is so-called peace and freedom." Now, wait. Hold on a second here. So if people turn out in huge numbers to yell at the Trump in chief, they're not actually doing it because they disagree with him and his murderous policies. They're doing it because they disagree with the benign and benevolent goals of the United States. So despite the fact that Bush has been president for less than 3 years and has already managed to invade two countries, not to mention piss off the entire world community, everyone who shows up to protest him actually hates peace and freedom? What year is this, 1984? And speaking of weird crap going on, let's have this Judge Roy Moore. Now, we've been commenting on the Roy Moore story for a long time now in the Democrats on the ground, but we are pleased to report that he finally got his just desserts last week when an Alabama State Judicial Ethics panel booted him out of office. Now, Moore's rabid tendency to shove his beliefs down everyone's throats, not to mention his unhealthy obsession with a large chunk of granite — funny, I thought the First Commandment says something about not having any other gods — led to his downfall, not to mention the fact that chief justices really ought to be able to follow the law themselves. Moore was unrepentant. Funny, I thought Jesus said, never mind, and vowed, "You will hear from me again when it comes down to the right to acknowledge God." Newsflash, Mr. Moore, everyone's already got the right to acknowledge God, dude. You just need to learn the difference between acknowledge and shove down everyone's throats against the law. Incidentally, Mr. Moore's attorney was apparently heard on CNN last week favorably comparing the ex-chief justice to George Wallace. Now, as for those of you who are unfamiliar with George Wallace, he was a staunch segregationist who became famous in 1963 when he had attempted to prevent federal authorities from enrolling two black students at the University of Alabama. So, I guess that's the kind of hero Judge Roy Moore wants to compare with, okay? Okay. By the way, a little off the track here from their text, Governor Wallace was the governor that they were singing of in the Leonard Skinner song, Sweet Home Alabama. We all love the governor, and we all did what we can do. Yeah, right. There you go, Leonard. Let's support that. Next on the list is Bill Riley. Oh, please let this one be true. Oh, please. It was revealed last week that the blowhard who blows harder than anyone else, Bill O'Reilly, may be considering a run for president. Certainly the option is open if I want it, said Bill, although he also acknowledged that he wouldn't stand a chance in hell of winning. However, I have to say that I'd be thrilled of a prospect of an O'Reilly candidacy. I mean, how awesome would it be to watch the thin-skinned jerk self-destruct every time he was put in a tough spot by a reporter? Not, of course, that a reporter is ever going to do that. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. To be fair, Bill wants to make sure that everyone knows he would be a serious candidate. I'm not a vanity player. I'm not going to go out like Al Sharpton to get on Saturday Night Live to run for president, he said. Yeah, right. Not a vanity player. Nice one, Bill. That's pretty funny coming from a guy who manages to turn every single segment on his TV show into a commentary on himself. So please, Bill, if you're reading this, if you're listening to this, please run for president. I'll even send you a donation. $10 and a handkerchief to blow your nose in while you're having your nightly bout of self-loathing. Okay, I personally won't send him $10. That was from the Democratic Underground people. I wouldn't send you a damn dime, you scumbag. Speaking of scumbags, here comes Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, in a bizarrely O.J. Simpson-style turn of events, Arnold Schwarzenegger has hired a private investigator to investigate himself. The groping Austrian beefcake made a campaign promise to look into the allegations made against him. And to be fair, unlike O.J. Simpson, Arnold actually appears to be keeping his promise. But I can't help feeling that this is all a little odd. I mean, the dude just got elected and now he's investigating himself for sexual harassment? Can't he just ask himself whether he did it or not? What does he need the PI for? Tell you what, though, I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that the private investigator will clear Arnold of all charges. I've interrogated Governor Schwarzenegger thoroughly and determined that there was absolutely no wrongdoing involved in any of these incidents. Apparently, the breasts and buttocks of the alleged victims actually flung themselves at Governor Schwarzenegger's hands. Case closed. Nothing to see here. Terminator 3 is now available on DDD. Check stores for details. Next up comes Ken Conroy. Now, conservatives are always keen to demonstrate how much they respect veterans, providing that they approve of those veterans' opinions, of course. A group of veterans were forcibly removed from a Veterans Day parade in Tallahassee last week by the parade organizer Ken Conroy because they were offensive. The crime? Disagreeing with the current war in Iraq. They can have their free speech, just not in the parade, Conroy said. They belong on the sidewalk. Meanwhile, the parade, which, according to the Florida Times Union, contained several high school marching bands and even a group of young women from the local Hooters restaurant, continued without the veterans. I guess in future Veterans Day should be appended to Approved Veterans Day, where we're only allowed to honor those who don't have some kind of controversial opinion. Ah, the land of the free. And Jeb Bush, too, is also among the list this week. While we're on the subject of Florida, it's nice to see the return of Jeb to the list after a long absence. What's Jeb been up to? Well, last week he was having a bit of a joke with the good people of San Francisco, suggesting that they may be an endangered species. Bush was holding a cabinet meeting when the subject of environmental land came up. While viewing a map of the U.S. which showed the locations of endangered wildlife, Bush said it looks like the people of San Francisco are an endangered species, which may not be a bad thing. That's probably good news for the country. Ha. I guess. I'm not entirely sure why Governor Bush thinks this is a good idea that the people of San Francisco are an endangered species, unless it's got something to do with the fact that one thing San Francisco is famous for is its large population of homosexuals, and how therefore it would be good if they were all wiped out. But I'm sure that's not what Jeb Bush was getting at. California's new Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger immediately made a statement defending San Francisco. Actually, nah, he didn't say anything at all. I guess he was too busy investigating himself. Just when you thought Tom DeLay, who's next on our list, couldn't get any more irritating, he comes up with a scheme that is so desperately annoying, it makes being stabbed repeatedly in the ass seem like relaxing in a meadow on a pleasant summer's day. Here's the deal. Tom DeLay has been sending recorded phone messages to people telling them that they've won a National Leadership Award and that they should return his call ASAP. When the unsuspecting award recipient calls back, "Gotcha!" telemarketer comes on and hits you up for cash. Get it? If you give $300 or $500, you win the National Leadership Award. According to MSNBC, past awardees included a convicted sex offender and maker of drug paraphernalia. although apparently both awards were later rescinded. Why, did their checks bounce? But seriously, thanks again, Tom. Every time we think you've hit rock bottom, you manage to surprise us. And finally, we finish up with the Republican National Committee. Yes, the RNC managed to stop CBS from airing the Reagans because they are not, but they're not stopping there. No, sir, the RNC isn't content with merely setting the record straight. They want to take the record off the record player, polish it, replace the stylus, add a new pair of top-of-the-line speakers and some of those monster sound cables, then take the record and... enough of the record player metaphor already. You know, nobody buys records anymore, guys. Anyway, the RNC has announced tentative plans to produce their own Ronald Reagan story titled, The Real Reagans. If it's anything like that epitome of unbiased truth, DC 9/11, then we could be in for a real treat. Picture the scene. A muscle-bound, shirtless Ronald Reagan has Mikhail Gorbachev in a headlock and is using his own Gorbachev's own hand to punch him in the head. Mr. Gorbachev, stop hitting yourself and tear down this wall. All right, I admit you have won the Cold War. Boy, that was the worst Russian accent ever. Reagan gives Gorbachev a wedgie, then uses his laser eyes to carve his own head into Mount Rushmore. Hell yeah, I'd watch the shit out of that. Anyway, thanks to Democratic Underground for providing me for a few minutes of good material. And we will see you all next time on the Cup of Joe radio show. This is once again your host, Joe Vecchio. Take care.
I was walking down the street on a sunny day. Hubba, 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 hubba. A feeling in my bones says I have my way. Hubba, 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 hubba. Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things are going your way. Hey, hey. Yeah, my little dog Spot got hit by a car. Hubba, 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 hubba. Put his guts in a box and put him in a drawer. Hubba, 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 hubba. Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things are going your way. Hey, hey. Forgot all about it for a month and a half. Hubba, 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 hubba. I looked in the drawer and started to laugh. Hubba, 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 hubba. Cause I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things...